This is the Ministry in Daily Life program here at Holden. My name is Otto Bremer. I'm a retired Lutheran pastor. I still teach two courses at the Graduate Theological Union, of which PLTS, our Lutheran seminary, is a part. They kind of explain what my passions are. One is strengthening laity in ministry. And my strong conviction that the real church are the people who are out in offices and factories and classrooms and hospitals and homes during the week, and not what really goes on at the church building. My second passion is the course I teach on ethics and economics, where I'm convinced that we neglect the business world, we neglect the opportunities and challenges of Christians in business. And I taught for a while in an economics department at the University of California in Santa Barbara. And there the students knew all about economics, but they didn't know much about ethics. And now I'm at the seminary, they know a lot about ethics, but they don't know much about how the system works, you know, and whether it should work the way it does. Yesterday we talked about some of the biblical backgrounds of for why we have ministry in daily life and why the real church are the lay people. Today we'll talk about occupations, vocations. And then on Thursday and Friday, we'll talk more specifically about the world of business, if any of you are interested in that. We were talking yesterday about there's different places where we do ministry. There's ministry in the church, and that's very important. You know, we wouldn't sustain our congregations and our activities and without people to teach Sunday school, to usher, to do it beyond committees and finances and all of the things that go on ministry in the church. There's also quite a bit that the church structures for us and gives us opportunity in terms of programs and outreaches, soup kitchens, counseling, community activities that the church structures, and we get involved in the church's structured program. But the third area is ministry in the world. And that's where the people who are worshiping on Sunday are out in offices, factories, classrooms, homes during the week. And yesterday we talked about why it is that the Bible is so insistent on what it means to be a Christian in the world. And because God so loved the world. He didn't just love the church. He didn't just love we Christians. He loved the world. And if we are to represent God in the world, remember we talked yesterday about those of you here, about to image God in the world. Now, to be in the image of God is really to be the ones who represent God. The image in Hebrew is a plastic term, that which represents like a statue or a painting. And our understanding of ourselves as Christians is to be the ones who represent God in the world all the time. In this area of different places for ministry, I think the occupational life is the most neglected. You know, we go off to our job, and that the job is a job, and home is home, and we don't really relate very much to that. What I'd like to do is to brainstorm a little bit. Sometimes if I've got, I'm doing an all-day seminar or something, I'll break you into groups to do this. Part of what we'll be doing today is giving you examples of things you can do when you get back home. But I want you to think of, either while you are still working or when you were working, what are the assets and the liabilities of consciously being a Christian on the job? And when you go to your job, you're thinking of yourself as a Christian. let's just see if we can get some things up here. Assets or liabilities of consciously being a Christian on the job. In fact, some of you were at the senator's session yesterday where he talked about being a Christian in politics. Okay, there's some assets and liabilities you talked about.
Image?
What?
Image?
Image. Now, what is that an asset or a liability?
That could be both.
Okay. Well, what does it mean?
People perceive you.
How people perceive you. That's going to be a big, big problem. And what would be an asset of how they perceive you?
Credible.
Okay.
Fair.
Mm-hmm.
Accurate.
Prejudice.
That goes on the other side, doesn't it? Okay, prejudice.
Actions.
Asset liability.
I would say it could be on both sides, but your actions towards your co-workers and your actions towards your customers, your clients.
Okay. And so if you are Christian, do you treat your customers differently than if you're not a Christian? I'm trying to see
who the customer is.
What?
Sometimes it depends on who the customer is.
Right. But you mean you treat customers differently if you're a Christian? Don't treat them differently?
From their perception, yes.
A lot of this is what people will perceive. How about your co-workers? How do the co-workers perceive a person who is openly Christian?
In general, they probably perceive him as a good person.
Good person.
Fair.
A wimp.
What?
Yeah, soft.
Open?
A wimp, she said.
A wimp. Okay, all right. Wimp. How do you spell wimp?
Preachy,
right? Preachy.
Too religious,
you know. Sometimes we call that holier than thou.
Okay.
That do it? Holier than everybody else. Not
on the asset side, a good listener.
Good listener, okay.
Open.
James said to be.
Well, we could spend a time on this, and if you give a chance, you know, in your home congregation to get people together and talk about what are the assets and liabilities. Oftentimes it's very difficult, particularly if you're not a Holden type group, you know, and you're meeting in a parish, to get people to say anything about liabilities. It must be great to be a Christian, and sometimes they're talking about what ought to be, rather than what is. In fact, that's not going to come through. There are important to keep four kinds of questions in mind. What kind of question are you asking? Are you asking a what is question? Are you asking a what ought to be question? Are you asking a question about how do you get from what is to what ought to be? Or are you really talking about motivation? And I find a lot of the conversation, not just in ministry and daily life, but in a lot of areas, is that we don't clarify the kind of question we're asking. You know, if a person comes to me and tells me about all the the frustrations on the job and all the pressures to be dishonest or whatever the person might be talking about. I should be a good listener, as we pointed out, you know, that and not say, well, that's, you shouldn't talk that way because that's not the way things ought to be. Because the person isn't talking about what ought to be. He's talking about the realities that he or she experiences. Oh, you're just... And what the answer to the what is question ought to be scientific, empirical. It should be reflect what really is, you know, descriptive. What ought to be is a totally different kind of question. You know, it's not scientific. You know, you never ask how a frog ought to behave, you know, or how a microbe ought to behave. You describe how a microbe frog does behave, you know. And those are so scientifically, the what ought to be is a very difficult question to get in. We're much more comfortable with the descriptive and the what is kind of question. In fact, we're very uncomfortable with the tension between what is and what ought to be. You know, if I know that the way I behave on the job is not the way I think I ought to behave on the job, you know, I've got a problem. One way of avoiding the problem is to do away with the tension. You know, that we look at what is through rose-colored glasses and we see the world as we wish it were, and we also scale down the what ought to be, particularly, you know, when we start looking at God's intentions for us. You know, he didn't mean us to take it that literally, you know, when we read the scriptures, you know, it's some of those James passages and some of the things we were talking about yesterday and God's intentions for us. And so we tend to put that together. In fact, how many of you are familiar with cognitive dissonance? You ever heard of that? It, you know, that is a real problem for us. Because cognitive dissonance is if I've got a knowledge in my brain somewhere, you know, a cognition, and I will block out other information that is in conflict with what is already in my mind. So I don't see that what I am doing is different from what ought to be, if I'm firmly convinced of what ought to be. You know, this is something that we need to be very much aware of, that we perceive things very often the way we want to perceive them. And so when we're talking about what is, it's not always what really is. And then we have to figure out how to get from what is to what ought to be. And usually that's not one giant step. You know, you've got to take actions that may make that are closer to what ought to be than what is now. And that means compromise. And I think one of the big questions for us is compromise a dirty word? Or is compromise a positive step to the future? Yeah. We could argue both sides, you know, scripture, I think, you know, that to, but let me suggest that you can never compromise with what ought to be. Now that's God's gift to us, God's intentions, his intentional will for the world, what he wants the world to be like, or she wants the world to be like. That you can't compromise. What is, it shouldn't compromise either if you perceive it correctly. But you may not be perceiving it correctly. We may not be perceiving God's intentions correctly. I might think that I understand God's intentions very clearly. It may be my understanding of God's intentions, not really God's intentions. And so we need to be correcting one another on all of this. But we should be willing to fight for what ought to be. But we're probably going to have to fight little battles, not one huge war that's going to all of a sudden make everything the way it ought to be. That's not going to happen. Not as long as we understand who we are as sinful persons. Let me do something. Some of you, how many of you know about the Ministry and Daily Life program of the ELCA? Yeah, I know them. This is a wonderful program. If you sign your name to this list, you can go on to the next page. You'll get the newsletter and some of the brochures. And I also, they sent me some of these. This is the latest brochure that they have from Ministry in Daily Life. And so, before we're all gone, those of you who didn't sign up yesterday and want that, make sure that I'll send that to Chicago and you'll be on the mailing list. Before I get into talking about the two things that I want to focus on, one are the resources of the Christian faith for this daily living life on the job, and other some of the obstacles that our Lutheran theology presents to us as we try to be Christians on the job. As we look at the assets and liabilities, we probably can see that some of those we're talking about what ought to be. What Christians ought to be like. They ought to be good persons, they ought to be accurate, they ought to maybe we're not all that good. One of the things that I did one time was go into, these were mainly businesses in Santa Barbara when I was teaching down there. I set up an appointment, I wanted a chance to talk to you about a research project I was doing, and that's where you get into offices, And I said, what I want to talk about are the values that are important to you on the job the same or different from the values that are important to you off the job? And these were managers of companies or subsidiaries or something like that in Santa Barbara. He had to explain what a value was sometimes to make sure you were talking about the right thing. And I generally think of a value as the criteria on which you make important decisions. What's behind the decisions you make? I interviewed about a dozen of these managers. They were all men in this case. How do you think they would answer that? Well, how would you answer that? Are the values that are important to you on the job different from the values that are important to you off the job? Now the senator yesterday made very clear that his values are the same on the job and off the job. That he doesn't start playing things.
I think only those that require certain skill competencies for the job. But as far as our response to people, or theories, right. Ideologies,
they would be different.
Mm-hmm. I would think they would have all said yes.
The values are the same.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If they got that high in management, they would have to have some tact. You'd be surprised if they
and give me what I wanted today.
Yeah,
what ought to be, they would be saying, not what is.
You didn't say they had to be honest.
Right. You wouldn't do that, though, would you? It's put down the middle. About half of them were almost insulted that I suggested that they had values different on the job than off the job. Others could describe, the ritual. There's chairs anywhere you want here. They could describe the ritual, of going from the dog-eat-dog competitive world to the domestic tranquility of home and hearth and all of that. The, and I, you know, that bothered me a bit when I was getting that answer about them being the same. And so I came back after the first couple of interviews with the question, now if you're trying to persuade your wife, as I say, these were all men, to do something, or if you're trying to persuade a colleague at work to do something, is there any difference? Silence. I'd asked for a half hour time for this interview, and every one of them went over an hour. They started to realize that their values on the job were becoming the values off the job. They knew how to manipulate people. They knew how to listen in order to get people to respond to them. So they started using that at home. There was one person of all the dozen or so that I interviewed who maybe was the most honest. He said, "Yeah, I know you have to be smart. I've studied all the leadership material and all of that. I know you have to listen to people before they listen to you, and I'm good at it. I wouldn't be in my job, you know, as he said, if I wasn't. But when I go home, none of this mucking around, you know. When I say it, I don't want to explain it. I don't want to manipulate people. I'm just, it's true. I'm going." He was a very good pilot at home, you know, because he didn't want to play games. I suspect that some of that goes on, that we compensate off the job for the kinds of things that go on the job, and we need to be aware of that. What is ministry in the workplace? What does it mean to be, we talk ministry in daily life, and one of the areas of daily life is our job. One time I was at Des Moines, at Jerry's church there. There was an area workshop on ministry in daily life, Saturday we had probably 150 people or so there. So we divided them up at one point by occupation. You know, those who were in healthcare, those in education, those in management. In fact, there were a dozen or so who said, you know, I'm in computers. You know, so a dozen or so computer freaks over here, you know. So I said, okay, now the first thing I want you to do is to brainstorm around the table now. What are the things you do on the job that you would see as ministry where your pastor could help you? And they went right to work. You know, communicating my faith, listening to people, living up to expectations, you know, of what I should be as a good person. I got that down. And I said, okay, now let's change hats and think of all the things you do on the job that you would think of as ministry. But the pastor probably couldn't help you. Silence again, you know. How could it be ministry if the pastor doesn't know how to do it? You give us a couple of examples, you know. How do you do a performance appraisal? A performance appraisal that really, you know, gets information about how well the person is doing and yet affirms the person and enables them to grow and on the job, you know. Pastors aren't very good at that sort of thing, you know. Most of them. They don't have to do it. In fact, at one point, I was the chairman of the personnel committee for the old LCA, in the Office of Administration and Finance. We decided we need to do a performance appraisal, you know. We just lived off, you know, doing it the way God wanted us to do it and not worrying about any of these measurements of things. And so there were two parts of it. I wanted them separate, but they wanted part to talk about, you know, performance appraisal, what the person is doing, competencies, and another, career development, whether the job was providing the career development that the person wanted. And when we finally did a survey, you know, of all the people who were doing performance appraisals and receiving performance appraisals, and everyone who was receiving a performance appraisal said almost all of them said, no, we did not talk about career development. All the ones doing performance appraisal said, yes, we talked about performance appraisal. You know, but it somehow, you know, there's a way in which you communicate that you are caring about the person and not just provide measuring performance. And those are all challenges to us. Or how do you set up a nursing schedule in a hospital that provides the needs of the hospital, you know, and the hours are covered and all, and yet recognizes the individual persons and the individual needs and things like that. Well, with a couple of examples of like that, they went to work. You know, and they came up with all kinds of things that where they were influencing the lives of other people. You know, I tell managers, maybe the most important thing for you to think about, or anyone that has people working for them, is how do the people who work for you go home at the end of the day? And they go home feeling good about themselves, and they go home and they're even ready to go to church council meetings to share with their family and all. Or do they go home feeling manipulated? You know, one false move away from out the door, you know, kind of situation. And maybe they don't even get home. They take it out on themselves at the local bar before they get a chance to take it out on their family when they get home. And so that the impact that we make is why I feel that the ministry in the workplace is so important. So let me go now to what I would call the we'll see if this works. The first resource is knowing who I am. We all know who I am. Well, in the James Bible study this morning, he was talking about, you know, the importance of the question that is being answered by James is, who am I? You know, we need to be aware of who I am. Another way we Lutherans talk about this is, what justifies my existence? We don't say that. We talk about justification by grace through faith, you know. But it's really the question of what makes my life worth living? What gives meaning to my life? And I don't think we equate enough what justifies my existence with the question of what gives meaning to life. But if I know who I am, if I know that my life is a gift from God, I've got a tremendous resource. Some of this early insight came when I was the campus pastor at University of California, Berkeley, in the 50s. Some of you are old enough to remember the 50s. The attempted suicide rate on the Berkeley campus, this isn't anything to do with, this is the McCarthy period, you know, everyone is hiding behind something. But the attempted suicide rate on the Berkeley campus was 5 times the national average. And, you know, I'm the campus pastor, I'm visiting the unsuccessful ones in the hospital. The pattern was almost always the same. Something gave meaning to life. It was the PhD. Once I got my PhD, everyone will know that who I am and that my life is worthwhile. Then they run across the language course or the statistics course or something that they know they're not going to make it. And logical, they attempt to end the life that has no meaning anymore. Or they found another person who would tell them that life is worthwhile. A fellow student, you know, they were in love. You know. Then something happened, and the person who was giving meaning to their life and affirming their meaning no longer was affirming it. And that's where the idea that what gives meaning to my life became so important for me in understanding what goes on in our daily lives. But, you know, is indeed another way of talking about justification by grace through faith. It's a gift from God that my life has meaning. If I'm out in the workplace and I know who I am and I know the meaning of my life, I'm in a much better position internally and externally than the person who doesn't know. If I don't know what gives meaning to my life, I'm vulnerable to all kinds of manipulations. You know, that they can get me to jump through hoops I didn't even know existed. You know, if they to do it, you can get the rewards. You know, the new titles, the special parking place, you know, the responsibilities, you know, all of which are very good. But if I need them to know who I am, then I'm vulnerable. And I think that one of the resources we need to talk more about is the message that we know who we are, that we're God's people. I was doing a workshop one time at San Jose State University for unemployed space engineers, mostly from the Lockheed plant, which is there in Sunnyvale, or Mountain View. It was an amazing experience. The kinds of people there were workshops on job opportunities in Louisiana and how you manage a household without an income and little questions like that. But I was doing one on the meaning of being unemployed. And the people who came, who had some knowledge of who they were, they still had all these problems about whether to move or not to move, you know. But there were others who came totally discombobulated. You know, they were so without any worth, because all their worth was tied up with the job and the title and the position. That now without that, they didn't know how to even begin to think about whether to move or how to cope, you know. And so that one of the resources that we don't do enough of it with translating into what it means to ministry in daily life, the ministry of individual persons, and we keep it too theological, you know, we clergy types, and we need to get it out there. A vision of society. This is the back in the what ought to be. What kind of an asset resource for us is to know God's intentions for the world, to know what the good society is, to know what the true community is, to know what true humanity is. We've got some starting point to ask that question, what ought to be. You know, there's a book that I was Leslie Weatherhead that came out with a book on the will of God. It's, he was a Methodist preacher in England, but he said, you know, there are three understandings at least of the will of God. There's God's intentional will of God, and that's what we mean by what ought to be. But how God visioned the true humanity and true community. Then there's the reality that we are sinful people, that God's intentions were not fulfilled, and we're in a situation where what God intended to be is not what is, and we're faced with the circumstantial will of God. What would God want us to do in these circumstances? And these are the kinds of things we face on the job all the time. But we have to know what that intentional will of God is, that vision of society, before we can deal with the tensions of it not being the will of God that we are experiencing. Now, when we get in more into the management and the things, we can talk about what this means to the. The planning function of an organization, whether that's business or not, because there is a real sense in which so much of the planning that's going on in our society, under all kinds of strategic planning and all that, is simply picking up signals from what is possible, not with what ought to be. And if we've got a sense that we know something about not just what our personal opinions about what ought to be, but what are God's intentions. And we have a confidence that God is God, not just another opinion out there, but this is what the intentions are for all of us. We've got a framework which to start thinking about the vision of society. And so much of the panic that goes on in our lives is when we forget that God is in charge. God is really God. And one of the books that was when I was high school or college age, Let God Be God. It was a good Lutheran theology. It wasn't just sitting around and deciding among ourselves what ought to be, but listening to what God. And then Weatherhead says, after we've talked about the intentional will of God and recognize the reality of the circumstances and the need to determine what is the will of God in this circumstance, or the circumstantial will, there's that confidence about the ultimate will of God. That in spite of all the obstacles, or in fact even through some of the obstacles, God's will, intentional will prevail. And that gives a tremendous confidence when we're working out there. The next one is freedom from the compulsion of perfection. The Bible says, be ye perfect as the Father in heaven is perfect. So I have no problem with that. That's the intentional will of God. The problem comes when I start thinking I'm perfect, or that I have to be perfect. For all of our emphasis, and as Lutherans, if you are, on forgiveness of sins and the reality of renewal that comes in forgiveness, we sometimes act and live our lives as if we're trying to avoid ever having to be forgiven. That we want to always be able to appear before God as ones who have achieved God's intentional will and all. And it's a very healthy, I'm preaching to the converted, I'm sure. you at the end of the day, when you sit down with God and look at things from God's perspective, how do I shape up? Not against what I did yesterday or what all those other people did that aren't as good as I am, but what did I do in relationship with God's expectations? And if I don't have to pretend that I've done all the things that God wanted me to do, then I've got some renewal. I've got some possibility. So much of what goes on in relationships is the person who always has to be right. To be right is good, right? Not always. If I'm the person who's the manager and I have some people working for me and I am always communicating what I believe and what I know to be right, I've conveyed a very strong message that you better not disagree with me. That I really don't want to hear stupid ideas that don't agree with mine. And so there's no dialogue, there's no innovation, there's no. And parents do that with children. We do it with friends, we do it in committee meetings. If we can be the authority, and we're good, some people get very good at nipping any other opinion in the bud, But if I'm open, if I'm sure that my ideas aren't perfect, And I really want ideas from other people. I maybe even want ideas from my children on how we as a family can be a better family. I'm in a much better position to live out my daily life. I want to be sure that we don't understand this to mean that God doesn't want us to be perfect. That's God's intention, and anything short of that, all the cognitive dissonance in the world isn't going to make it so that we are really the perfect people that God wants us to be. But we know that He loves us and accepts us, and justifies our existence as we are, even though He is working with us to make it better. Now the gift of community is what we're doing here, which is what we come to hold and define, people to share our ideas. But sometimes we don't structure as much as we should. In a congregation, there can be people with similar occupations struggling with some of the same problems who don't find support. It's never structured so that they come together. Some congregations have done a good job with this, and others have have not seen this as important. I was saying yesterday, that when I started to visit the employed people out on the job, that made a great deal of difference in the perception again of people as to what was important to the church. That for the first time, someone was interested, and I wasn't there to tell them how to do their job. I was there to find out what their job was and how they were doing it, and how did they ever think of it as ministry, and things like that. And if one of the advantages of having a small congregation, in a year's time, a little over a year, I was able to visit virtually every employed person. They started telling me that they listened differently to the sermons, because sermons are general. Put this into effect in your daily life. But they said, "Now I know that you know where I am in my daily life, and that makes a difference to how I listen to what you're saying." And it's something, the faith to go, the risk. This is not an entrepreneurial affirmation here, but there's so much that we do that needs a sense of trusting that God is with us. Abraham goes out and he knows that God wants this vision, this trip, and so Abraham and Sarah go. I feel sometimes that in our congregations, in our own lives, we are so American in terms of our conditioning into rational understanding and calculate, not calculation, I don't mean it's bad, planning. It's stupid, isn't it? To try something where you know you don't have the resources to complete it. In a planning operation in an organization, that would not be very wise. We get to where we plan everything we do on the basis of our resources. And what I know we as an organization, or I as an individual, are able to accomplish. And then we sit back and talk sometimes about, I never experienced the presence of God in my life. We never put ourselves in a position where we needed to experience the presence of God, where we were out there, where we needed to be reminded of resources we had that we weren't aware of, or weren't counting on. Anyway, there's a lot in this. Now, very quickly, I want to talk so we can have to, I don't know the I thought it was right in this deck, but it's not. The obstacles. Gary Pence is the dean of the faculty at the Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary. And when I was teaching this laity class, he put together Obstacles to the ministry of the laity of the Lutheran theology. And I was shocked. But you know, we need to think much more about how people actually hear what we good preachers are saying. You know, I've said one of the great resources, you know, is knowing who I am, justification by grace alone. I don't need to prove my worth by any of these worldly success stories or anything like that. You know, that easily becomes, you know, what sometimes we Lutherans call total depravity. You know, that I'm incapable of doing any good. And don't you even think about doing something good, because you may start being prideful and thinking that you're justifying yourself by good works, and we know that's not what was. Now, I don't know whether you ever get caught up in something like that, but I think there's a lot that we are saying sometimes that we are overly dependent on God and don't take responsibility for our own lives and for the things that we do. Reminding of all the things, you know, that when we start thinking we're perfect or any of those sorts of things, we're into trouble. But we are meant to be influencing the world for good. We do we will, for better or evil, most of us, as we interact with people. Lutherans are very heavy, as you I'm sure are aware, on the second person of the Trinity. You know, we are a Christ-centered church, and our theology is the theology of the cross. You know, and I wouldn't be a Lutheran if I didn't believe that was the centrality. But there is a theology of creation. And you know, we're being dragged into it, you know, by kicking and screaming sometimes, into recognizing that our responsibility is not to dominate the world, you know, as we were saying last night, but to be co-creative, to nurture nature, or the work of the Spirit. We're so scared of the Schwärmerei, as Luther used to call them, you know, the people who were too much into the Spirit, and speaking in tongues and all that. But you know, there are gifts of the Spirit. And we Lutherans should reach out and embrace the gifts of the Spirit and not be so narrow in that. Anyway, there's the ways in which we can overdo the emphasis on the second person of the Trinity. We've got a few more minutes. I apologize. Any questions? Anything? We got 10 minutes or so. How does this relate to your own daily life? I think that's where we can share the most fruitfully.
I think some of the points that came out in John's presentation yesterday about Christian.
Right.
And I find myself never using that word.
Mm-hmm.
I'll refer to church or Lutheran.
John was talking about, you know, a candidate being identifying himself or herself as the Christian candidate, you know, that probably is not the way it should be. Any comments on your situation in comparison to some of this?
Are you talking to me or John?
Either one. Go ahead, John.
Well, I mean, it's a whole lot of what the political world is similar to other things, too. I mean, a lot of who we are comes from our faith and how we bring that to the job. I mean, I was reading through this brochure you passed around, too. And yeah, people, everybody in their own occupation finds different ways to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not necessarily just telling others about their religious faith. It's how they treat others and how you spend time with people, how you relate to others.
Right. Do you have a comment?
No.
No?
I was kind of thinking about his comment about the that there is like an ease to say the denomination rather than Christian. Because I was thinking about the liabilities of their after it's hit by man. And that in the workplace, you can actually alienate people too. I don't know if that's a liability or an asset.
Well, well that, but if you alienate people, that sounds like a liability to me.
By them knowing what you are, and since Christianity is a fellowship, and others that you work with become a fellowship, it becomes an alienation to those who are disbelievers.
Yeah.
And that can then stand, I think, in way of productivity in terms of right, job.
Right, right. You know, if your couples, just take one of these. This is most of what I said in the paper is in this paper, so you can take it with you. Resources of the Christian faith.
You know, I equate Christianity with what was the pyramid company? Everybody's trying to get sold the cleaning goods and
Amway.
Yes.
Amway.
Because
oh.
Yeah, somebody says Christian, I'm checking to see where my money is real quick because know you're going to get hit by something. It's coming.
There's some distressing things that happen too, but you know, by people known as Christians, scandals, in past years too, different groups. So it's association by what is the question, I guess, and what's easiest.
I've done something in Salt Lake, giving presentations in Salt Lake City to predominantly Mormon companies. And that's where I get scared about taking your faith into your daily life, because it can have a lot of negatives, who you actually recognize as people. Go ahead.
I just had a comment in your reference to doing job performance reviews. I do that as part of my job, and I've been criticized as being, the words are that I'm too kind, or that I'm too gentle, I guess the flip of that is to become more assertive, and that word to me has some of a negative connotation. I think probably there's a way that you can be assertive that's not negative. But I struggle sometimes with that as a Christian, because the flip is to be the type A business person that I don't think is right either. And so I think there's a fine line between that, and I struggle with that.
Because there's a real struggle going on there. It's interesting that some of the studies have shown that the reason managers do not do a better job of corrective performance appraisal, saying things that are critical of people, is their own justification. They want to be liked. They don't have the freedom of knowing who they are, that they have to have other people like them. And if you want people to like you, you're involved in a lot of dilemmas about who I am and all.
I think it also, as soon as you're hard on somebody else, that forces me to be extra hard on myself. So if I can tell somebody else that they need to improve in this area, it brings me up to that point, which is something to take on.
I think one area where ethics is a problem is we all, or many of us, have had to write progress reports, or there were annual reports that had to be written, or political people have to report on how they're doing. And I think your tendency is always to try to emphasize the good things and downplay the bad things, and so there's a certain amount of ethics involved in how you report.
Oh, yeah.
There's a fine line also, I think.
There's the same tension that we will talk about more in management, but the person who has hired a person and says, you're a great person, and you're the person that's going to succeed in this job, and I've selected you, sometimes doesn't want it. Gets the message out, I don't want to hear any failures that you have, because I believe in you so much that you just cover up reality for a long time. Yeah. And the person may have been going, over the edge performance-wise, but you look at the record and there's not a negative comment. Let me put out some things over here on the table. Two books that are in the bookstore. This is Of Human Hand is vignettes about people. It's kind of like the two that are in that brochure that are written. And then this one, The Once and Future Church. If it's an analysis of what is happening when we move from the old Constantinian established church where to be born was to be a Christian, you know, and there wasn't a mission. The mission was overseas, you know, the mission field. So we were privileged as Christians to stay in the parish and give our money to have the missionaries go overseas. And this is, the subtitle is Reinventing the Congregation for a New Mission Frontier. And the mission frontier is in our offices, in our neighborhoods, in our cities, and all that. So these are two books that are in the book. Bill Deal has a number of books. This is Monday Connection, but he's got Thank God It's Monday and some others that you can... I don't have that. I don't even have the bookstore. This is from a laity project at Andover Newton Seminary up in Massachusetts. Nine Blocking Enabling Forces for the Ministry of the Laity. And I think I got copies enough here. And then this is Ministry Through Vocation. This is from Ministry in Daily Life. Do I see my daily work as an offering to God? The kind of question, these are more to take home and get a group of people together in the Sunday morning forum or something to talk about them. And then this is more about me. When I retired, my niece has a little public relations company up in Salt Lake City, and she said, Uncle, you need an identity. So this is not a business, but it's the kind of things I'm interested in. And, you know, I don't want to carry those back either. So I will look forward to chatting with you. Go ahead.
I've got a question. It's not necessarily, I think it parallels this class, but is there a similar class for the youth for how they can minister, say, in school, in high school, in college?
This is where it has to start. You know, that if we tell our young people you're only preparing for ministry, they're not going to understand.
But is there something existing now that can be brought into the church, into the youth program, just to do that? Maybe our minors or our young people up here could be exposed to something. But how would a student in a school, particularly with the present day peer pressures on them, be able to withstand and how to minister?
Well, I mean, some of you may have noticed that I carry this mug around for Lutheran Men in Mission, and. One of the things that we're trying to develop a program of mentoring, where men will, in the inner congregation, will consciously become mentors, and largely in terms of daily work, you know, occupations for young people in the congregation. And I think those are the kinds of things that would be positive and all to develop. But well, let's talk some more, because I think this needs to be brought to other people's attention. And kind of with the staff, it's happening here with the teenagers and all.
Lutheran Brotherhood Insurance has something called
the Teen Team.
I wish Lawrence knew about that.
Okay, we'll see some of you the next time. That's on Thursday. Oh.